Ian Trottier here. Discussions of Truth is the name of the program. Second day, reawakening tour, Colorado Springs, Clay Clark. I have with me Kirk Elliott, economist, entrepreneur, philanthropist. Kirk Elliott, PhD.com. Kirk, who are you?
I'm a wealth manager. I've been doing this for about 27 years.
You got great glasses, by the way.
Thank you. You know, glasses can either make you look cool or nerdy, and I think these make me look cool and nerdy, right?
Yeah. And nerdy's cool.
Yeah, nerdy is cool. Nerdy is cool. So, well, thanks for the compliment. Yeah, I've been a wealth manager for 27 years. Funny story, when I first got into the business, you have to start somewhere, right? And it's brutal. So the firm I was working for slapped a phone book.
New York?
In Durango, Colorado. But it was a national firm. Great place to have a national firm, right? In a place where it's beautiful. It's like paradise. But they slapped a phone book down on my desk and said, here's your leads. It's like, what? So
wait, what is a phone book? Okay, never mind.
Yeah, I know. You know,
the yellow pages, right? The yellow pages, yeah.
Exactly. So I made 250 phone calls a day for the first 3 years. It's just what you have to do. If you have a dream, you have to fulfill it, right? So, but it was brutal. So I was watching TV. Jim Cramer on CNBC is like shouting from the rooftops, just screaming, and everyone's listening to him. It's like, how can I get on TV? Because I want to be on TV. So I got a PhD in public policy and administration, focusing on monetary economics. So I developed a new methodology for measuring inflation for central banks. It took me 7 years to do it.
Central banks?
Central banks, yep. Because the way that they measure inflation is bogus. It's garbage, and it's understated. From the Clinton administration in 96, they came up with the Boskin Commission, right, the party for the people, right? And they said, hey, how can we understate inflation so we don't have to pay out as many benefits to people? So they started messing with core CPI numbers, and it's just completely bogus. So basically, my algorithm that I developed says you take core inflation, that CPI number, and multiply it times 2.8, that gets you the real number. So with inflation today at 4.5%, it's really truly at 13%. Well, a guy named Dr. John Williams at Shadow Stats has a different algorithm. He measures inflationary pressures too. Same exact number. So it's like, all right, I guess we're on to something here. So why is this all? So anyways, I did that, but then I decided I'm a glutton for punishment because one wasn't enough. So I got a second PhD in theology. And now it's like, all right, sky's the limit, right? So the floodgates started.
Financial opening. Theology.
No, just regular theology. Just theology.
Theology in general.
Theology in general.
Defining theology.
Yeah.
Or expanding on the definition of theology or whatever, yeah.
Yeah, just, biblical knowledge, theology, right?
So, wait. Biblical theology?
Yeah, biblical theology. Okay. Yeah. So, got two PhDs. So how do these two actually combine, right? It's like, why do you even need one? I'm a glutton for punishment, I suppose. But I got both of them. But that started opening up the floodgates. I got on TV, got on Huckabee's show, got on Daystar TV, and I did a documentary. It's like, this is pretty great.
You're like, Cramer, I'm coming after you, dude.
I'm coming after. What that means is I get to go on TV and I get to talk for 20, 30, 40 minutes at a time rather than paying $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 for a 30-second spot on like Fox and Friends or whatever, right? So now I don't have to charge that to my clients. We get to lower our costs of investing. And what we do is significantly different than most other firms. Most other firms are transactionally based, Ian. So, which means like a real estate agent, stockbroker, they make a commission when you buy, a commission when you sell, and they forget about you the rest of the time. We're different. I believe that those kind of transactions are like the necessary evil to be in the right place at the right time. You have to buy, you have to sell to allocate into a trend. But life happens in between those bookends, right? So we want to go through this financial journey with our clients and let them know when it's time to buy, sell, reallocate, get out of Dodge. We blend the political with the economics, with the social landscape of the land to reduce people's financial anxiety. The only way we can do that is through communication. Trust only is developed through communication, right? So we stay in communication with all of our clients, and we're significantly different. I mean, Grant, I just know we are different than most firms on the planet. And right now we're focusing on precious metals, gold and silver, because it's the only thing that makes sense right now. You know, I'm a firm believer. Time and place for everything. Time and place for everything. During the Trump administration, during the Reagan administration, what policies did they have? They had lowering taxes, lowering interest rates. Well, as Americans, we do one thing better than anybody on the planet. We spend money, right? So if you can increase our bottom line by lowering taxes, decrease our cost of borrowing by lowering interest rates, we're going to stink and spend that. And that's why the stock market boomed. But you have to fast forward now to today. It's like, is it the same? No, opposite policies. Rising taxes, rising interest rates, inflationary pressures. So Americans are going to spend less, which means the stock market is toxic right now. It's poised for a massive correction. But those exact fundamentals that caused the stock market to come down caused gold and silver to go up. So we're allocated into gold and silver right now. It's simple. It's minimize risk, maximize return, and just move forward with that passion, with that fervor, and that confidence, knowing that, hey, it doesn't matter for your finances what the policies in Washington are, because I can always find something that will grow, even in a Biden administration. I can find something that will grow, happens to be gold and silver.
Pharmaceutical company?
No, I wouldn't do a pharmaceutical company right now because they're poised for destruction.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's scale that down. And I love where you're going with the metals because you're speaking my language. And we may go off a little bit of base here.
Sure.
But we'll come back around.
I'll roll with you.
Silver certificates released by JFK in 1962, I think it was. You could walk into a bank and you could submit the certificate to the teller. She exchanges that, or he exchanges that, for a piece of silver,
right?
In your models, in your algorithms, in your approach to studying economics over the span that you have, why don't we have that today in the United States?
But I'll start in the early 1900s with the Federal Reserve Act. See, prior to the Federal Reserve Act in the 1913, what happened? The dollar and gold were interchangeable. A 1 ounce of gold has $20 face value on it from back then, or you could have used a $20 bill. Well, the Federal Reserve Act is not federal. It's not reserve. It's a cartel family, right? It's a bunch of seven families that basically run the Federal Reserve. The Rockefellers, the Rothschilds, it's what it is. So,
can you name the seven?
I can't name the seven, but I could get them for you.
Okay, so, but what you're saying is it's a private organization.
It's a private organization, yeah. Primarily the Rothschild family owns it. So what did they do during the Federal Reserve Act? It was done over Christmas. Congress was not in session. They went to Jekyll Island, Georgia. They passed this at midnight when nobody was there. Basically took the printing of money out of the hands of Congress and put it into the hands of a private banking cartel. Well, now, there's no tangible backing to it anymore. They got rid of gold so they could just print. And then when the government needed it, they made the interest payments on it. So all of the interest on our federal debt's going to the Federal Reserve. And all they're doing is having the guy in the gray jumpsuit going to pressing the button on the printing press and say, oh, let's print it, right? There's no tangible backing to it anymore. So what has that done? It's eroded our currency, the value of our currency, to almost the point of monopoly money. So let me give you an example. Back in the 1920s, when gold and the dollar were convertible, you could have gone to the store, could have gone to Woolworths or Sears or whatever was around back then, right? But what would it have bought you? $20 or 1 ounce of gold would have bought you a finely tailored men's suit, a shirt, a tie, a belt, and shoes. Fast forward to today. What does $20 get you? Well, you can't even go out to Chili's on date night, right? But 1 ounce of gold at about $1,700 an ounce still buys you a finely tailored men's suit, a shirt, a tie, a belt, and shoes. Gold maintains its purchasing power over time. View it as insurance against a collapsing currency that they are inflating. That's why we have inflation, is because they keep printing. No tangible backing. It devalues the currency, and it takes more of that junk currency to buy valuable goods and services. That's why we have inflation.
Okay, so Kirk, talk a little bit about, now, it's been a few years, but I had Anastasia Nestatilova. She teaches economics at the University of London, perhaps, one of the institutions there in London. Her co-author, Ronan Palin, the two of them, I hosted the two of them. I says, I posed a question to Anastasia. I says, this is Anastasia. What is wrong with fractional reserve banking? Is that simply debt-based banking? That was led to Ronan Palin speaking of the City of London being controlled basically by a charter that exists from 1066 that William the Conqueror was unable to conquer the actual City of London. You're talking about the Rothschild.
Right.
And so people that are familiar with my work, and Andrew Griffin or whatever it may be, understand that the Rothschild, as you said, control over the past few hundred years, or a couple, 300 years, the Bank of England. I may have those the figures wrong. How does fractional reserve banking, Kurt, in the layman's terms, how does fractional reserve banking equate to a troy ounce of gold?
So if you fractional reserve banking, let's say you invest $100 or you put $100 in the bank, in the checking account, savings account, what does the bank do with it? Well, they take a piece of that. They only hold like 10 bucks back and they lend out 90. Well, then that 90, they keep $9 back. They lend out 81. See, and it keeps going down and down and down. So they have very little on hand, and they keep using other people's money to keep lending out, lending out, lending out. This is how banks make money. But at some point, they don't have enough on hand to actually cover it if there's a run on the banks. You know, you could have a run on the banks like right now. Since about 6 weeks ago, the Federal Reserve had a memorandum. They're doing what's called a reverse repo mechanism, pulling $2.5 trillion of liquidity out of the banking system. Banks are now strapped for capital. Well, 4 days after that announcement, Wells Fargo basically said, we're cutting all personal lines of credit. A 8-page letter from the CEO of Wells Fargo to all account holders saying, hey, your personal lines of credit, gone. And then about 6-7 days after that, James Grunvig over at American Media Periscope had reported that JP Morgan Chase is now hoarding cash. They're not lending out to Asian countries anymore, and they're making it difficult for U.S. consumers to get loans. So there's this liquidity crisis happening, okay? But that's all current, right? You have to go back to December of 2020, and they telegraphed everything that they were going to be doing. In December of 2020, the Fed put out a 98-page memorandum to 15 banks that said, hey, you have to submit an orderly resolution plan to the U.S. Bankruptcy Court by December 17th of 2021. You go to the Federal Reserve's website and look at it. It's just the memorandum from December 20th of 2020. Well, orderly, when you dissect the words, it tells you what they saw coming. Orderly resolution means what? Something was going to be in disarray. You have to resolve it. And then who is the recipient? The U.S. Bankruptcy Court. Who are some of these 15 banks? Well, the American ones are Capital One, U.S. Bank, HSBC, and the big boy was Northern Trust. Northern Trust handles all the custodial accounts for J.P. Morgan Chase. So what does that tell us? It says they knew that there was going to start to be a liquidity crisis the last quarter of this year. How did they know? I have no idea, except they knew because they foretold us back then that there's going to be, they have to submit orderly resolution plans to the U.S. Bankruptcy Court. So now we've got this all happening right in front of us, money leaving the system, banks shutting down credit lines. Here's the crazy thing. We deal in asset transfers all the time. People are wiring us hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars, buying precious metals, gold and silver, and then we pay the depository, right, for those metals. 6 months ago...
Can you name the depositories you're paying?
Yeah.
Please do.
Delaware Depository in Wilmington, Delaware. So that's where we store the metals in this country, where if people don't want to take physical delivery at home, because not everybody's a little bit different. I've got some clients that say, hey, we don't trust our metals being stored somewhere. We want to have them at home. Some clients will say, I don't like where I live. It's a dangerous neighborhood. I don't trust being on me. I got to store it somewhere, right? So everybody's different. But for the depository, that's where we would use. So we're wiring money back and forth all the time for physical metals. 6 months ago, never a question. Client would go to the bank, wire the funds, we'd get it, no questions asked. About 2 months ago, 70% of the time we started having issues. The bankers would say, hey, client, do you know these people? Well, we should investigate it for fraud. How long have you known them? We've been your safe stewards of all your money for forever. Why would you ever leave? And they were making it difficult for funds to leave. Now, I've had, within the last week and a half, I've had four clients where the banks have said, we're not sending your wire. We're simply not sending it. One particular client, and I don't know which bank she was at, but she had $2 million in her checking account, was sending a $250,000 wire. So there's capital there to cover it, right? Teller said, we can't send it. She said, what? It's my money. Let me talk to the manager. Manager said, we're not sending it. It's like, what? Let me talk to the bank president. Bank president said, we won't send it. Give me a reason why. This is my money. We don't have to give you a reason. So they didn't even know where the money was going at this point. They just were. That tells me that there's a capital issue, capitalization issue with banks, and they're simply got
with the retail banks.
Yeah,
but also with the correlation. Well, also with the correlation with the depositories.
No correlation with the depositories. Depositories are what hold precious metals for safe storage. Has no correlation. It's the banks that are sending the wires. They don't even, these particular transactions, the bank didn't even know where they were sending the money at this point. They just said, we're not sending it.
The banks, okay, continue.
So when they don't even know where the money is going, that tells me that they don't have it, and there's a liquidity crisis happening, and they're getting probably notification from the top brass saying, keep money in the banks at all costs. At all costs. So that's what we're starting to see. For me, on the streets, you know, front lines, working with clients who are sending money back and forth, we're starting to see the net effects of a liquidity crisis in the banking system.
The money being held in the banks is symbolic of what the Federal Reserve is controlling.
Correct.
Which is private withheld from the public.
Correct.
How do listeners at home confide in that system?
Well, it's becoming really difficult now when the banks have a liquidity crisis and they're starting to view clients' money as their own, saying, we're not wiring it. So how did I resolve that? I told the client, say, just cut me a check. Just send me a check. We'll have to wait for it to clear and just bypass the silly bankers who are telling you it's not your money, it's ours. We're not sending it unless we want to. Crazy. That's going to, if this starts to manifest itself more and more and more in snowball effects, people will start to lose major faith in the banking system, which is supposed to be your safe money, right? It's not. It's not anymore, in my opinion.
Clarify for listeners, clarify for myself. The client goes to the bank president and asks for her funds.
Mm-hmm.
The bank president refuses to release the funds.
Correct.
Does that mean that the bank president is now distrusting the value behind the funds that he's holding?
Well, I don't think he distrusts the value. I just don't think the value is there. Or he's maybe afraid for his job because he's gotten orders from higher up. I'm speculating here. But why would a bank president say we're not wiring your funds when the client obviously has more funds in their account than what they were wiring? It's because the funds possibly aren't really there. They needed time to actually acquire those funds to submit a wire, because a wire is immediate payment. Well, what if they don't have it? What if they can't reconcile it? Well, then they have to get an interbank loan that night, and maybe they don't want to do that. I don't know. But all I know is that liquidity is drying up. And 6 months ago, this was never an issue, ever. Now, it's an issue 70% of the time that the bankers are giving clients a hard time trying to scare them to keeping money in the system. And now we've reached a point where, I mean, it's not all, but we've had four instances in the last week and a half over probably 100 bank wires where they said, we're not sending it at all. At all. Wacky.
Why is this happening in your view, Kirk?
Well, because I think that the politicians have kicked the can down the road just a little bit too far and say, hey, we've got this debt ceiling issue, right? We don't have enough money. There's not enough government revenues to pay for all this. I mean, what? Biden's doing $4.1 trillion spending bills, $3 trillion spending bills. Who's paying for that when China has now been a net seller of U.S. treasuries for the last 4 months? They're not buying them anymore. In fact, they're selling them. So we have no more foreign capital coming in to for that nut that we need to crack to fund the U.S. economy, right?
So which is stagnant because of the lockdown.
Yeah. So now politicians are saying we need to increase the debt ceiling. We can't survive without it. Oh, well, to me, you know, when you can't live within the discretion of just printing what you need. So what they're doing is they're printing, devaluing the currency. It's turned into an inflate or die scenario. Because here's, we've got runaway inflation, right? It's 13% right now. How do you slow down inflation? Well, one, you raise interest rates, increase the cost of borrowing so people spend less. If they were to do that, it would kill the economy overnight because we have too much debt. The other way that you could do it, the only other policy that the Fed has is to stop stimulus, printing of money, right? You can't do that. The economy would die overnight. So therefore, they're just kicking the can down the road, saying the next congressman, the next congresswoman, they'll let them take care of it. But I think they kicked the can down to the edge of the cliff, and it's now falling off the cliff. I think they've hit the point of critical mass. And so this is why we're starting to see these pressures. Now we've got pressures of economic shutdown because of COVID. Well, fewer people working means what? Less sales tax revenue, less income tax revenue, less property tax revenue because people can't afford to buy houses. So now their own policies are just kicking themselves in the foot, right? Lower revenue, higher expenses, higher inflation. They just have to print their way out of it. We've entered an inflate or die scenario. How do you navigate through that successfully? By purchasing tangible assets. They go up with inflation, like gold and silver. But gold and silver are different than real estate. Real estate's a tangible asset, but it's not liquid. You have to find somebody that can qualify for it and all that. Gold and silver is liquid in instant. We can just sell it, wire the funds into a client's account, and it will go up with inflation.
Kirk, you're speaking my language, man, and it's wonderful to have this discussion. Why did Nixon abolish the gold standard in 71? Going against the Bretton Woods Agreement.
Going against the Bretton Woods Agreement. So the Federal Reserve made it basically, with the Federal Reserve Act, made it kind of illegal for Americans to own physical gold and use it as a fungible currency, right?
But and then FDR confiscating.
Yep. But now you still had international transactions, like France wanting assets from America. You could still pay other countries with gold and silver, right? So Nixon shut that window because France wanted payment back for a loan. And they said, we don't want stupid greenback. We want our gold. So Nixon said, we're not getting rid of the gold. You know, this is my interpretation of it.
Okay.
We're not getting rid of it. It's the only thing that we have that's value. So he closed the gold window. So now even international settlements between countries couldn't be transacted in gold. And France said, we want our gold. He said, nope, we're paying you back in cash. So what that happened is it accelerated. Now, not even gold internationally could be traded. And that started to accelerate the inflationary pressures from a fiat currency since the early 70s. And you look what's happened. You know, from my first story of the suit, tie, the belt, and shoes, right? We've lost 99% of the value of our currency. Just since the 1970s, though, we've lost 70% of it. This is insane. That's what happens when politicians are allowed to print money without discretion, because it's basically just at their own whim that they want to print it. And that's what gives us inflation and the loss of purchasing power in our money.
So, Kirk, should we, as a country, as a nation, we be returning to a gold standard?
Yes, and this is what Trump wanted. He mentioned it a couple of times. We got to go back to a tangible-backed, a specie-backed currency because it adds accountability, it adds transparency, it adds truth to a system. You know, this populist movement around the globe, what's populism all about? Truth, transparency, accountability. Trump was a populist president. Nigel Farage in Great Britain is a populist politician. Even Bernie Sanders is a populist, right? You don't have to agree with his politics, but that's kind of what he wants. So there's this movement around the globe for something that's real. Well, fractional reserve banking through a central banking system is not real. It's shrouded in secrecy. It's very opaque. So I think we are going to a tangible-backed currency. We don't know the date, right? We don't know when, just that we are moving in that direction. And I tell you what, if you own gold...
Which would mean you're
company and your organization would do well.
Well, my clients would do well because they would own the gold, right? So I don't own the gold that they own. They own it. So we're helping people set up for what it looks like the writing on the wall is. Our economy is about to collapse. The wheels are falling off this thing. And when we go into a gold-backed currency, anybody who owns gold before it backs the currency, it's almost like instant wealth overnight.
Okay, so go back to this. Go back to getting to that point of returning to the gold standard.
About getting to it? Well, it's simply put, our time in the sun has been squandered, right? When we were the world's reserve currency through the petrodollar, we could just print without discretion. There was still built-in demand for our currency. Well, 3 weeks ago, Russia and Saudi Arabia signed a bilateral agreement that said, we're not using the petrodollar anymore. We're going to trade in our own currency for oil. This is the first nail in the coffin of the U.S. dollar being the world's reserve currency. A world's reserve currency, that means all international settlements are traded in the U.S. dollar since Bretton Woods, right, to make international currency transactions more consistent, more stable, more trustworthy. Well, now nobody wants the U.S. dollar anymore because we printed way too much of it. We have too much debt and it's turned into monopoly money. So now you've got countries that are starting to pull out of international agreements. You've got countries that are now no longer buying U.S. treasuries. How do you entice them, like China, for example, to invest in U.S. treasuries again? Jack up the interest rates. Give them a reward for the risk that they're taking. Well, you can't do that because it'll kill the economy, but that's what needs to be done to slow down inflation and get more foreign capital coming in. I don't see a winning solution to it other than a complete reset. You change the currency from the Federal Reserve printing without discretion just because somebody wants to having it be tangibly backed. That'll give it credibility overnight to every other currency because there is no gold-backed currency in the world. Every currency in the world is fiat-based, right? This is why I think Trump wanted it so bad, because it's like, look, we have a tangible-backed currency. We'll be the only one. All international capital flow is going to come back to the U.S. dollar. Why would you go anywhere else if something was not real and you would want it to... Well, people want something that's real, right?
Right.
It's genius. It's genius, but it's squelched. It's stopped in its tracks.
So, Kirk Elliott here, PhD, economist, entrepreneur, philanthropist. Kirk, let me insert this now. In the early 70s, are you familiar with gentleman, his name is Dr. Peter Beter, B-E-T-E-R. Ever heard that name?
No, I have not.
So, Dr. Peter Beter was appointed to be the head of the Import-Export Bank by JFK.
Mm-hmm.
JFK, as we know, was assassinated, interestingly enough, just a few months, 3 months, I suppose, after inserting the silver certificates into circulation.
Right.
We know
right.
They were backed off of intrinsic value out of the U.S. Treasury and not this Federal Reserve system. We work our way to the Nixon shock.
Okay.
The release of the gold standard, the gold standard. And what we have at this time, in the early 70s, what we have at this time, now to give you the background on this, Kurt, I began doing my show in 2016 because I was exposed to something called the Zika virus in Miami and something that was a pesticide that was controversial and banned in Europe.
Okay.
So there was a local debate about that. I was quickly turned onto a guy named Anthony Sutton that was a researcher out of Stanford, Stanford Hoover fellow, who was writing about the conspiracy, Federal Reserve conspiracy,
right.
Blatantly, no theory.
Very familiar
conspiracy.
With him. Yep.
Okay. Now, through that kind of avenue, I began researching things, and I came across this guy, Beter, B-E-T-E-R,
okay.
Dr. Peter Beter. Now, what Beter was saying in the early 70s, what he was saying in the early 70s on his radio show was, folks, there simply is no gold in Fort Knox.
Right.
The Rockefeller sold it to the IMF at below market value.
Right.
Kirk, you're talking about depository here in Delaware.
In Delaware, yep.
Could it be possible that the United States is intrinsically unable to return to a gold standard?
So it's never impossible. You could have a gold standard with 1 ounce of gold.
Okay.
It would just be valued at, what, $7 trillion an ounce, right?
You'd own the country.
Yeah, so whatever available supply that there is, you just price it at a point where it's commensurate with the amount of dollars that are in circulation, right? Today, from what we know as the available gold supply, I mean, America supposedly has 8,300 tons of gold. The European Central Bank...
Well, you use the word supposedly. Listeners,
supposedly,
right?
Supposedly. The European Central Bank supposedly has 10,000 tons of gold, right? So if you use those numbers, it would put gold at about $20,000 an ounce to back the U.S. dollar. Well, it's not. $1,700 an ounce, right? So what does all that mean? It's like, we have to verify that gold is there to back the currency first. Once that happens, which is why there's been... Like, people like Rand Paul, even Ron Paul, his dad before him, were calling for an audit of the Fed. It's never been done yet. Trump wanted the Fed to be audited, right? So once these things start to happen, there's things that have to happen first before a currency gets backed by gold. You have to make sure that the gold is there, right? So I think these things will start to play themselves out. Trump is well on the way through an announcement, or basically a paragraph in the CARES Act, that basically said the Fed is under control of the U.S. Treasury. The Fed couldn't just print money unless the U.S. Treasury told them. They couldn't give it to whoever they wanted to. They could only give it to who the U.S. So with Trump, the stimulus was laser focused, and it worked. And it actually worked, right? Now it's just like, yeah, let's just print it and throw it against the wall and see what sticks. Very ineffective way of stimulus, but that's the way that the Biden occupancy is actually doing it, right?
Like how you phrase that.
Yeah.
How, for listeners, how do you interject Bitcoin into this and digital currency?
Well, I think that it's...
What are the risks? What are the values?
Well, I don't like cryptocurrencies as an investment unless it's placed in its proper position.
And you have a huge, thick gold chain around your neck. I'm kidding.
No. Yeah. So for me, for an investment, it needs to minimize risk and maximize return. I could technically maximize return with cryptos, right? Some of them are going through the roof. But it also comes with maximized risk. It could all go away tomorrow. I like tangible assets, which was why I don't ever really recommend crypto. Now, people say, Kirk, I've got millions of dollars in crypto. Yeah, try to take it out. You're limited on the amount you can take out every day, right? So, of course, the price is going to go through the ceiling when they have unlimited input, but they throttle the output. That's obviously going to cause the price to stay up. But to me, it's kind of phony baloney, right? It's like a fiat-based currency. What is it? Some kind of a digit somewhere. It's a one and it's a zero. Does it have value? Well, it has value as far as people think that it has value. That's nothing more than a fiat-based currency. This is why I don't really like it and why I love tangible things. Gold and silver have never gone to zero. Stocks can go to zero. Cryptos can go to zero. Do you know that there's over 2,000 cryptocurrencies? We only hear about 6 or 7 of them, right? 2,000. They come and go like people changing their underwear, right? They have no meaning because there's nothing backing them.
At what point in time in your career, Kirk, and you're double PhD, at what point in time in your career did you say, hey, wait a second, I've got to rely myself and my existence on something of intrinsic value? Where did you catch wind that, hey, wait a second, this Federal Reserve Bank is private, it's withholding information that's critical,
right,
to the healthy functioning of this republic and this government? Tell that for listeners.
So I graduated in 94 with my master's degree in international economics. My thesis for that, I was talking about these kind of things, the Trilateral Commission and things like that, and I read a lot of Sutton.
So that's why you know Sutton.
Which you already referenced.
And you know David,
right,
Rockefeller, because he's great.
Correct, yeah. So it was then that I decided. But I worked for a traditional stock company from like 94 until 2002. It was really in 2002 that I started allocating heavily into gold and silver. It was just a transition because my paper companies that I was working for said, hey, you can't even tell people about gold and silver or else you have to cease and desist. You're selling away. It's like, I'm not selling. You don't understand what the word selling actually means. I'm just telling people as a courtesy, you should put maybe 5% of your position into metals at that point. Well, I said, you can't do that. You're selling away. It's like, I'm not selling anything. I'm just telling people. I wasn't making money on it. So I said, cease and desist. Well, you know what? I believe they're not my provider. God is my provider. I'm never going to do the wrong thing for clients. I'm just going to bolt. So I left. And then I started doing gold and silver, you know, tangible backed stuff because it makes sense. Gold and silver have never, ever, ever gone to zero where everything else can. So it was back in 2002 in that I decided that that was the path I was going to go on.
History repeats itself. The Roman Empire eventually fell because the denarius, and I think there was another alternative currency, became so devalued over the different forms of governance from reign or whatever, that people simply had no more power, okay? They had no more power. I see, from my view, I see the same thing happening right now in the United States. What's the likelihood that Biden and his administration could possibly return the currency to a gold standard or something, a certificate? If you don't see that as being a possibility, why?
It doesn't fit their narrative. I think it's maybe 10% possible that it would happen under Biden. I think it's going to take a president like Trump to actually go there because they understand economics. I mean, case in point, a few weeks ago, Biden said, hey, I'm going to print $6 trillion of newly created currency injected into the system to stop inflation. What? That is inflation, moron. I mean, seriously, I hate to say that about somebody, but it's moronic. It's like, that is inflation. So it is not going to happen under a Biden occupancy. It's going to have to wait until you get a president that understands economics, a sound value of money, before that will happen.
I ask often, and even mainstream media is now saying it, even Biden is saying, hey, wait, I can't speak to you. I can't give a press conference. I'm not allowed to speak. He's being controlled. Who's controlling this man?
I wish I knew.
Is it possible, Kirk, is it possible that those shareholders of the Federal Reserve that are representing perhaps the seven families that you're... Let's just assume that people like a Bill Gates or who knows. Let's just assume that Bill Gates, we don't know. Let's assume that representatives, the shareholders... That
money makes the world go around. It's not just a saying, I believe. It's a reality. Who are the people that are controlling things? Well, look at who's controlling the policies of America right now. It's Facebook. It's Google. It's Amazon, right? Jeff Bezos and his clan. I mean, they're pretty
digital-based companies?
Digital-based companies, information-based companies, knowledge-based companies, right? Collecting information on everybody. I think they probably, my opinion, probably have enough money and enough clout and a lot of political pressure to get the people in that they want, which will establish a system that will allow them to continue to prosper.
What's the most revealing thing? It doesn't matter. Look, we're realizing that the United States is under revolution. I keep saying that. We are experiencing a revolution right now. It's nonviolent, but we're in a revolution. Okay, I view Antifa, I view BLM. These are elements of a revolution. These are civilian armies.
Right.
You have a thought. You have a comment. Go ahead. Run with that, because I've given enough. Run with what you're thinking right now. Just run with that. What are you thinking right now, and run with it?
Okay. The word revolution. 1776, we had two revolutions that year. American Revolution and the French Revolution. They were both based on freedom. The French Revolution, the peasants were uprising to try to take power away from the rich bureaucrats and the aristocrats, right? Well, the peasants won. And France today is still a socialist nation. 1776, so that was an anti-God revolution. But it's still a revolution based on freedom, right? But it was an anti-God one. The American Revolution, a pro-God one, they were looking for religious freedom. They wanted people to succeed. They wanted capitalism. They wanted people to work hard and be benefited from it, right? And America today was still a great nation with our freedoms eroding, right? So we've got another revolution right now. It's like this boiling pot. And under the surface, you've got two sides. Which one is going to win? Is it going to be French Revolution style in America or American Revolution style in America? Better be American Revolution style. But people are waking up, right? Because we're starting to realize that this government control, this government interference, even when you start looking at vax stuff, it's like even people on the far left are saying, what? I'm a flight attendant. I'm a nurse. I didn't vote for it. I just lost my job because I didn't want to take this vax, right? That's not freedom. Who knew that something like health freedom would be maybe the pin that breaks this juggernaut's bubble? But I think America's waking up, and I do believe that this revolution that we are seeing will end up in a good way for all of us, because America's starting to wake up. But with that, I do believe that we're going to see some dark times before we see light ones. I don't think it's going to be a nice rosy path to freedom. I think it's going to be battle after battle after battle after battle after our rights and our freedoms are being taken away, including our financial freedoms, right, which is what I focus on. We've got a lot of other people here at this conference that we're at that are talking about health freedoms and political freedoms and religious freedoms, right? Mine is more financial freedom based.
Follow the money.
But we
money
all,
make the world go round.
Yes, but we all need all of us working together to make this work so we can get a lighter America, if that makes any sense.
Makes perfect sense. Kirk, thank you for doing what you're doing. Leave some final words for listeners. What are some parting words that you like, listeners, folks that are listening and saying, this makes sense.
Yeah.
This really resonates.
You can't operate out of greed or out of fear. Whenever somebody operates out of those two primary motivators, especially in finance, they make the wrong decision. So people operating out of fear tends to do absolutely nothing. If you do nothing when the economy changes, you're going to sink with the ship. If you operate out of greed, like in the cryptocurrency right world, I got to get into Bitcoin. It's at 70,000. It's like you get in and you're always too late. Whenever you operate out of fear or greed, you're going to make a wrong decision. You have to operate out of wisdom and a sound mind. This is what we help people do. If you want, give our office a call. 720-605-3900. I will walk you through that process, hold your hand through this, or just go to my website, kirkelliottphd.com. We'll walk through it. Say, Ian sent me. Right? And I'll help you right away because we need to make sure that we're safeguarded. So those are some good parting thoughts. You know what? Don't operate out of fear. Don't stick your head in the sand. You weren't created that way. You weren't created with a spirit of fear. You were created with a spirit of faith and of sound mind, but you have to act if you're going to make a change. It's like as amazing as God is and can do anything, he can't steer a parked car. You've got to be moving. You've got to have action. It's not just enough to be a hearer of the word. You have to be a doer of the word as well and operate in the freedom and the sound mind and wisdom that we've been given that's ingrained in each one of us. And then what? We can thrive and not just have to settle for surviving in these markets that we're living in.
Kirk Elliott, double PhD. Double. Thank you for joining Discuss the Truth.
My pleasure. Thanks.